Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of the sixth session of our 2019 Becoming Buddha Immersion in the Dhamma Spring Retreat on May 18th, 2019. My Dhamma talks and our Sangha discussions are on the Anattalakkhana Sutta and the Fire Discourse. This session concludes with the Bhadakarata Sutta. The first two suttas speak directly to the heart of the Buddha's teachings and describe how views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths establish fabricated or corrupted views of self and the world. The Bhadakarata Sutta teaches that developing the refined mindfulness of the Buddha's Dhamma is truly an auspicious day. Information on our retreats is available at becoming-buddha.com, and if you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. There's three suttas that are considered the cardinal discourses of the Buddha, and they are the first three suttas, the first three teachings he ever gave. And in these three suttas, again, you hear me say this often, is really the Buddha's entire dispensation. And of course, he went on to explain it in different situations and how different situations apply. And this sutta is a good example of that. We heard the first sutta, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where he described the Four Noble Truths for the first time, and remember, Kandana understood it completely and awakened. So this is a couple of weeks later, still very early in the Buddha's teaching career and in the learning career of others. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. He addressed a group of five bhikkhus, or bhikkhus are simply people that have now devoted their lives to understanding. Is John coming out? I didn't see him get up. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying at Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering. And one could have it be any form desired, meaning you don't have any control over it, how could you consider it a self? One could have it any form desired and stress-free. So in this week or two since the Buddha first started teaching, they're still interacting and they're asking questions. And the Buddha's listening to their discussions among themselves, and he's realizing that they're expressing some concern about what is this self and what is these aggregates we're talking about. And so the Buddha's, this is a situational discourse about what just what they want. How are you, John? I'm glad you joined us.
I'm glad to be back.
Glad you're here. I'm going to start once more. Just
Tell me again the name of the sutta.
The Anattalakkhana Sutta. It's in the book. Yeah, it's in the section on the Buddha's first three discourses, I think is what it's called. And then the next one we're going to do tonight is right after this one. The Anattalakkhana Sutta. On one occasion, the Buddha was staying in Benares in the deer park at Isipatana. There he addressed a group of five bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, form is not self. Were form self, then this form would not lead to suffering, and one could have it be any form desired and stress-free. Since form is not self, it leads to suffering, and none can have it be any form desired and stress-free. Bhikkhus, feeling is not self, as perceptions are not self, fabrications are not self, consciousness is not self. If these aggregates were self, they would not lead to suffering, and one could direct these aggregates as one wished. And notice a correlation between the Buddha's teachings that we should have control over the form and that we should have control over our minds. And since we don't have control over our minds, we don't have control over our bodies. It's simply a fabrication. It's made up. That's why we don't have any control over what happens to it. Since these are not self, they can only lead to suffering, and no one can have these aggregates be as they wish. No one. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Well, the reason why I said that is there's a few people say, I know other people are having trouble, but I can do it. I can deal with it. I can make this form be as I wish. Bhikkhus, and isn't that really what we're trying to do with our lives, with fabrications? we're trying to make something out of this that we can't make anything out of. It's just six properties. We can create the appearance, the illusion. The Buddha often described the world of ignorance as not an illusion, but like an illusion. And we're the ones that are playing that trick on ourselves. Bhikkhus, how do you perceive this? Is form permanent or impermanent?
Impermanent, venerable sir.
That's why I asked us that last part. The five relied, impermanent, venerable sir. Now, is what is impermanent painful or pleasant? Painful, venerable sir. Yeah, you can answer. Now, what is impermanent, what is painful, since subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as self?
No, sir.
Is feeling permanent or impermanent? Is perception permanent or impermanent? Are fabrications permanent or impermanent? Is consciousness permanent or impermanent?
All are impermanent. Venerable sir.
That's a better, yeah.
I've heard this one before.
Yeah, you heard it once before, or twice, or three, or every retreat you heard it. Now, is what is impermanent, what is painful, since it's subject to change, is this fit to be regarded as this is mine, this is I, this is myself? No, venerable sir. So, bhikkhus, any kind of form, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding how it actually is, be regarded as, this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. So imagine how importantly deflating this would be to someone who is thinking about all these different ways that he can fabricate himself in different forms, in different realms. And the Buddha saying, stop it. There's nothing there to do that with. It can't be done. You can imagine yourself into it and imagine that you've accomplished it, but it's just an illusion. And so it follows that any kind of feeling whatever, any kind of perception, any kind of fabrication, in the particular translation, I put the word in determination, but that's, I don't want to get into why, but I'm just referring to fabrication. Any kind of fabrication, any kind of consciousness, whatever, whether past, future, or presently arisen, whether gross or subtle, all these different ways we try to imagine ourselves, whether in oneself or external, whether inferior or superior, I'm no good, I'm better than everyone. This is a common problem even during the Buddha's time. Whether inferior or superior, whether far or near, must, with right understanding in how it actually is, be regarded as this is not mine, this is not I, this is not myself. Bhikkhus, when a noble follower who has heard the truth sees in this way, they find estrangement in form. Again, it's a translation from the Pali, but it's the perfect word. What does estrangement mean? It means we have what was once familiar to us, we've now grown strange. It's not familiar to us. We don't know it. We've grown estranged from form. We're no longer clinging to form. They find estrangement in feeling. They find estrangement in perception. They find estrangement in fabrications. They find estrangement in consciousness. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. It leads directly to tonight's sutta. When we find estrangement with these five aggregates, the passion for maintaining a fabricated self, according to the Buddha, according to experience, simply fades away. Again, the self-referential ego self wants to find something to have to do with these things. It can't be just recognizing an abandonment or renunciation. But that's exactly what we do. If we feel that we need to do anything else, heal this broken inner self, prior to awakening, we're just distracting ourselves from awakening, according to what the Buddha taught. And I will qualify, I had some discussion with Chris about that. What I'm not saying, and I'm sure if there was a psychological model in place during the Buddha's time, he wouldn't counsel people about getting any kind of therapy, because oftentimes that initial change in direction in the way you're thinking and feeling is an important part of eventually developing the Dhamma, but also be mindful that it isn't the Dhamma. But sometimes people need a little bit more help than is available in the Dhamma. You know, that's just common sense. It's around today. We've developed some very useful psychological models. We've also developed some very damaging psychological models, haven't we? I mean, that's ignorance occurs. Ignorance is present. But the point that I'm making is we shouldn't just completely discount something because it's not the Dhamma. You might gain that by the way I teach, and I don't mean to imply that. So this is a good example of that.
The great thing is we have a research base now that shows which kinds of things are effective and which kinds of things create more hurt. And that research base is building and building.
Yeah.
And there's more and more research about meditation, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any trouble recommending a few therapists that I know because I know that they're mindful based and some people just need them. You know, that's great. Go do it. Make yourself available to it. I mean, I don't have to go too far with it. When they find estrangement, passion fades out. With the fading of passion, they are liberated. It's kind of counterintuitive, especially to the way Namarupa wants to live its life, anatta. My whole life, I'm passionate about establishing and maintaining this view of myself in the world. That's what drives me. That's what gets me out of bed every morning. And people have that thought that what happens when I let go of that passion? What's going to get me out of bed in the morning? What is going to get you out of bed in the morning?
Dhamma practice.
A well-concentrated mind with that refined mindfulness. And it'll get out of bed because it's time to get out of bed. When liberated, there is a knowledge they are liberated. We know it. If this isn't something that we have to guess about or somebody says, well, you've been doing this for so long, so you're advanced, you're good to go. We know it. We know it ourselves, personally. Nobody can qualify it for ourselves. When liberated, there is a knowledge they are liberated. They understand. Birth is exhausted. The integrated life has been lived. What can be done is done. Of this, there is no more beyond. There's nothing else to do but live your life. Now during this discourse, the hearts and minds of the bhikkhus were liberated from craving, aversion, and deluded thinking. They awakened. Kandana and now these other four friends awakened after the second discourse. Simple and direct, isn't it? It's a complete teaching on the fabrication of five clinging aggregates, the personal experience of suffering. The great liberation of that is there is that realization that this whole thing, this whole problem of suffering, greed, aversion, and deluded thinking is a fabrication. It's ultimately like foam on the water. There's nothing to it, even though it can seem very substantial and difficult to penetrate at times. There's really nothing there. Next sutta.
False evidence appearing real.
Yeah, that's right. And we're the ones that are presenting that false evidence to ourselves, aren't we? And insisting that it's real. This is called the Adita Pariyaya Sutta, or the Fire Discourse. Now this is, again, the setting. This is the third discourse, about a month later. And word has spread of the Buddha all over northern India and southern Nepal. The Buddha was staying at Gaya Head, with over 1,000 in attendance. There he addressed those assembled. Friends, the all is a flame. What all is a flame? And look how this relates to everything we've been talking about this weekend. What all is a flame? The eye is a flame. Forms are a flame. Consciousness at the eye is a flame. Contact at the eye is a flame. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fires of aversion, and the fires of delusion. A flame, I tell you, with birth, aging, and death, with sorrows, regrets, pain, distresses, and despairs. The Buddha's description of dukkha. The ear is a flame, sounds are a flame. The nose is a flame, aromas are a flame. The tongue is a flame. Flavors are a flame. The body is a flame. Tactile sensations are a flame. The intellect is a flame. Ideas are a flame. Consciousness at the intellect is a flame. Contact at the intellect is a flame. And I just said that. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too is a flame. A flame with what? A flame with the fires of passion, the fires of aversion. Another word for passion in this sense would be greed. So these are, the Buddha's referring to the three defilements. Aflame with the fires of greed, the fires of aversion, and the fires of deluded thinking. All of those, the three defilements, feed this ongoing inflamed way of living in the world. And it's really an apropos metaphor. I failed to mention the reason why the Buddha's given this particular, using this particular metaphor as fires. There was a popular fire cult in this area at the time that used fire worship in their rituals. It's still common today in some places. And so he used that metaphor just to show that overstimulating yourself through eye making, through this type of passion, burns yourself up. It causes constant pain, even though we might not realize it. But seeing clearly, the well-instructed disciple of the noble ones, they grow disenchanted with the eye, disenchanted with forms, disenchanted with consciousness. They grow disenchanted with contact at the eye. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, with that too, they grow disenchanted. They go disenchanted with the ear, they grow disenchanted with the nose, they grow disenchanted with the tongue, and they grow disenchanted with the body. So what does that mean in practical terms? It simply means that I am now no longer enchanted by my fabricated view that is using my senses to continue fabrication, to continue illusion. Would somebody please turn the light on so I can see you all a little bit? They go disenchanted with the intellect. They go disenchanted with ideas. They go disenchanted with consciousness at the intellect. So do you see now the beginning of the renunciation? The interruption or the cutting of the clinging that is constantly reinforced by the sixth sense base? A wise Dhamma practitioner knows you can't trust it when it's fabricated. You can't trust your own senses, because my senses are what? They're aflamed with passion. Up until this point, now that I'm lucky enough to have found a Dhamma, but up until this point, I've been using my senses to keep me inflamed, to keep me passionate, always grasping after things. And it is at that point of contact between who we are in the outside world and what we're experiencing that we practice the Dhamma. Again, in this present moment, this is where the rubber hits the road, right here, right now. They grow disenchanted with contact at the intellect. That's the Buddha saying just what I just said. It's at that point of contact that we grow disenchanted. We can fabricate it or abstract or make it an abstract idea of what we want to do, but that's not going to get us there. It might help provide us a little bit of direction, but the Buddha, again, is teaching these thousand friends, it's practice at the point of contact. It's practice at the five clinging aggregates, at the personal experience of suffering, at anatta, at our belief in, at our fabricated belief in self, where karma is unfolding. All of that, what I just said, is right now. It's all happening right now. There's no self in the past. There's no self in the future. There's no Dhamma in the past, no Dhamma in the future. There's no passion in the past and no passion in the future. We can only manifest all of these defilements in the present moment, but because our mind is stuck in the past and the future, we're not here. We're not here for what's occurring. If we were here for what's occurring, we wouldn't do it. So the Buddha taught a way to be here while it's occurring at the point of contact. Do you see?
Yes, Venerable Sir.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry. I can't, if you're shaking your head yes, I just can't see it. So please say yes. Or no, you can say no too. You don't have to agree with me. And whatever there is that arises in dependence on contact at the intellect, experience as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, they grow disenchanted with that too. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are fully released. Through dispassion, we are fully released. Does anybody here want to generate dispassion in their lives? Honestly.
Yes.
No. Yes.
Are you sure?
Kind of yes.
Because
yes.
You may not want to, and that's okay too. That should be acknowledged. Pardon?
It's like yes and no.
Yeah, for some of us it is. I'm not sure if I want to give up this. What? But though, I mean, that's a reasonable question and a reasonable consideration. At some point, we're going to have to make a determination that, yes, I realize this is all fabricated and I want to get rid of it all. I don't want to live this way anymore. Or we decide, this works pretty good for me. Let me keep going. And then you might decide, well, I like that meditation technique that the bald guy taught, so I do that. But the Eightfold Path is not all that important to me. And all that's fine. Again, I'm just making the point that if you want to awaken as a Buddha taught, you do what the Buddha taught to do. But if you don't, that's fine too. There's no right or wrong in that. Disenchanted, they become dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are fully released. With full release, there is the knowledge, I'm fully released. We know it. They discern that birth is ended, the integrated life fully is fulfilled, the task is done. There is nothing further for this world. This is what the Buddha said, gratified. The monks were delighted at his words. And with this explanation, while this explanation was being given, the hearts and minds of the thousand in attendance, through not clinging, meaning not sustaining their ignorance, their fabricated views, were fully released from fermentation and the effluence, the aversions. They awakened. I think that's the end of the sutta. Yes. Thank you. That's the fire discourse. So did you see the connection between the two in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta?
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's just a simple and direct teaching on how to apply the Dhamma in this moment at the problem of eye-making that is reinforced by the senses. Say you agree with me. You understand that.
Yes.
And I know I'm saying the same thing over and over and again in maybe different ways, but really to emphasize that point. The Dhamma isn't in the past, in the future, tomorrow, when I'm ready for it. It's right now. And if I'm not practicing it right now, the wonderful thing about a timeless Dhamma is I can practice it in the next now. Meaning I can start whenever I want to. I can stop whenever I want to. And I can always pick it up. It's always there. It's a timeless path. But right effort says, once I've started, let's keep going. Let's take it to its ultimate conclusion. Why not be released from passion? Why not grow dispassionate? Why live in confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing experiences? Again, I've asked you a few times today to imagine this and imagine that. Imagine having a week in your life with no disappointment at all, no unsatisfactory experiences. That's what the Buddha's teaching. Imagine living a life like that. It's pretty wonderful. Again, it doesn't mean that things that would normally be disappointing don't happen. This is not a way of manipulating phenomena. It's a way of being at peace with phenomena. One more sutta tonight. A quick one. And you'll see how it fits in. I always like to fit this one in. It's a short one. But it really describes... It describes what we're doing and how important this is. The Buddha was staying in Savatthi.
A lot of the things I feel the most passion for, the more I practice, the more I enjoy those. So like loving my daughter creating something in the world for others. I have a lot of passion and drive toward that. And then the more I practice, the better I am at giving that.
Yeah. And again, the context
is...
There's
definitely still passion toward it.
Well, again, the context is so important. The Buddha's talking about passion for continued eye-making. Passion for maintaining a mind rooted in ignorance.
So this is not really passion toward that. It's actually passion toward not making an eye of it so that I'm better at giving.
It can be, but the Dhamma is, no one else can know. I can know. I don't know the answer to that question. Okay. But the Buddha teaches us how we can know.
Yeah.
If there's eye-making involved, if there's stress involved in what you're doing, then it's rooted in fabrication. If it's stress-free, the Buddha was passionate about teaching the Dhamma. That's what got him off his cushion every day. But it wasn't rooted in any fabrication. It was simply rooted in reality. And you can hear it in his words. I mean, this isn't... the one I just read, you can hear the enthusiasm in the Buddha's voice too, can't you? But it was a type of passion that's not rooted in fabrication, it's rooted in reality. Again, it's an awakened life looks just like an unawakened life. Most people won't be able to tell the difference. But who cares? Our experiences, the things we're involved with will likely be the same. I mean, some people make pretty big changes. And we'll enjoy our life, but we'll enjoy it in a peaceful and sublime way. And there won't be me making this enjoyment. It'll simply be involved in my life, which again, I talked about when I was young. I couldn't figure out what was wrong. Really what was wrong, and I talked a little about the Yankee thing and using that as an example, I wasn't there. I wasn't present for my life. When you're not present for your life, life sucks. No matter what you try to build about it. But if you enter your life through mindfulness and a well-concentrated mind, no matter what happens is what happens. It doesn't suck. It doesn't not suck. It's just what's occurring. It's calm and peaceful. Let me read the sutta. The Buddha was staying in Savatthi at Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. There he addressed the monks that were gathered. Friends, I will teach you the meaning of an auspicious day. Has anybody heard the sutta yet? I will teach you the meaning of an auspicious day. Do not chase after the past or project your thoughts onto the future. Bring your mind and body together. Not entangled with the world, be mindful only of what is occurring. Again, be in your body. Free of distraction, well concentrated, develop now. You can put those words in there, even though they're not. Now you can develop compassion informed by wisdom. We talked about this, didn't we? Compassion that is not informed by wisdom can often be very cruel. Mindfully engage with what is skillful. Again, there's no ambiguity about what is skillful. What is skillful? The Eightfold Path. The future is uncertain and death occurs equally for all. Those who remain mindfully engaged with life as life occurs throughout the day have had a truly auspicious day. So how do we have an auspicious day? How do we have an auspicious day? With life as life occurs. Again, there's the whole Dhamma. And how does one avoid chasing after the past? How does one? I mean, that's, if you ask somebody who really didn't have any understanding of the Dhamma, how could you answer that? How do you not chase after the past? The only thing you could possibly say is, well, don't do it. Don't go there. That pop, don't go there. Well, how can I not go there? My mind is conditioned to go there. I need something to break that conditioning so I cannot go there. The Buddha understood that. He gave us an Eightfold Path. And how does one avoid chasing after the past? One does not get carried away with the delight that in the past I had such a form, in the past I had such a meaning of body, in the past I had such a feeling, in the past I had such a perception, in the past I had such a fabrication, in the past I had such a consciousness. What's the Buddha referring to? It's bad enough that we're stuck in this five clinging aggregates in the present moment, but I'm grasping onto them in the past too, in my experience of them. And what is it? What am I grabbing onto? What is my desire driving me to make something special out of the past, whether it was a traumatic event or winning the lottery? I'm still hung up on it. Yes, and what's happening to me right now while I'm doing that? Any possibility of true healing, true awakening is gone. It's lost. Even though I think I'm doing what I should be doing, even though I'm doing something that is often encouraged to do, to find some answers. And it's all taking me out of what the Buddha says to be mindfully present with what's occurring. Again, this is the point of the Buddha's teaching about a well-concentrated mind and avoiding that speculative establishment in non-physical or imaginary realms. It's so, and again, this is referring to directly to that. How does one not project their thoughts onto the future? One does not get carried away with delight that in the future I might have such a form, such as in the future I might be an awakened Buddhist, or I might be this, or I might be that, or I might make it to Tulsita Buddhist heaven where I'll be taken care of forever, or I might find myself at the side of Jesus, or any of that type of thinking. And again, I'm not putting down religion, but that is a fabricated view, isn't it? Because it's purely speculative. One does not get carried away with delight that in the future I might have such a form, in the future I might have such a feeling, in the future I might have such a perception, In the future, I might have such a fabrication. In the future, I might have such a consciousness. So in practicality, how does that work out? In the future, I might have such a feeling. Well, especially for Dhamma practitioners or Dharma practitioners, it could be, I really need to meditate because I don't feel good. So let me go meditate. Do you see the subtle eye making and the misuse of meditation there? Some would say, well, it's okay because it got you on your cushion. It's not, because you entered meditation with the wrong intention. An intention fueled by craving and clinging. An intention that I be different than I am. And let me use something that should not be used in that way, And it also avoids the disappointment and frustration when we don't always feel good after meditation. Because we're not supposed to. We don't have to. It's not part of it. Although, the more we deepen our concentration, we will feel better. We will be more at peace and more calm. But when we try to establish it as a dharmic goal, it's simply a fabricated, speculative application of myself in some place that cannot exist. Is that clear?
Yeah, use it as an escape.
Yeah, and again, so something as useful and effective, directly effective, as Shamatha Vipassana meditation, when we even use it with the wrong intention, it loses its ability to do the thing that it's designed to do, to deepen concentration.
So, John, you said before that meditation's good, but if you don't want to do the full path, that's fine, but it's not fine.
Well, yeah, I mean, in the in the biblical sense, it's fine. In other words, I would rather, I think I might have said something like this to you, Chris. I would rather see somebody doing any type of meditation, whether it's this or that, than sitting in a tavern at night, or maybe even say than going bowling. Not that there's anything wrong with bowling, but it might improve yourself if you meditate, or at least meditate before you go bowling and sit at the bar. But if you want to be a Dhamma practitioner, if you want to develop what the Buddha taught, you'll practice what the Buddha taught.
I mean, to use Chris's meditated but did nothing else, she couldn't have the capacity to truly love her daughter without ultimately having dukkha. You understand it because you practice. So it's
I mean, it frees us of all that type of speculative. I mean, I'm sure you, I mean, we all would take care of our children, and we all probably reasonably worry about our children. We think about them. We hope that they're always safe. But we don't lose our minds over it, do we? Because if we do, and we've all, maybe not, maybe I should make that statement. Most of us know people that are so overprotective of their children because of that extremely fabricated view, that they really damage their kids. I mean, that's kind of common, isn't it? So the practical applications of the Buddha Dhamma are complete. It's applicable to every single life situation, and it helps. But to answer David's question, I would say most, a person just picking up any meditation, it's better than nothing. But I was again talking to Chris earlier, I've now met many people that engaged in meditation alone, didn't have the framework or the guidance of well-informed Sangha to understand what was occurring, and meditated themselves into deep psychoses. And that's not uncommon. And if you think about what most meditation is taught, it's really to get into your head and just keep thinking about all the things that you're thinking about. And when you do that in an unstructured way, all you're doing is putting emphasis mostly on the things that hurt you in the first place, or that you hurt yourself with. And so you're simply increasing it. You know, there's a saying, I mentioned Arnold Patton, one of the things that he said is what you focus on expands. It's not 100% true, but it's mostly true. And so if in meditation all I'm focused on is kind of what's wrong with me and what might happen to me, what am I doing? I'm just deepening my anxiety, and whatever psychoses I might have is going to be exaggerated by that. Let me finish this.
John, you had said something about if you're going to meditate to feel better, that's not the proper use of meditation. But if you wanted to quiet and calm yourself because maybe you were in a tense situation or a difficult scenario. What is that called? Like, what do you, you know?
Oh, I would say that that's a mindful use of the meditation technique in that situation. What I'm saying is to not view your meditation practice as a practice to make yourself feel good.
Right.
You know, but of course, yeah, I mean, that's...
But it is an outcome.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, the outcome, but it's not the focus. It's an unintended, or maybe I should put it this way. It's an
A lot of times I come home and I've been in the car for a long time, and it's a transition point.
Yeah.
I, you know, put my stuff down. I, you know, change or whatever, and then I take a few moments and I sit on my cushion and then I go into my meditation, and it's a transition point, and I think I'm using all the, you know, the skills and the everything that you've taught us.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're dealing with the distractions that bother you at that time. So and this is what meditation is for. It's
yeah.
distraction.
Yeah, and that prep that you're doing, well, I ask you, Mary, directly, what's your intention for meditating? Why are you doing it?
To deepen my concentration.
You're good to go. And really, I mean, but again, if you said your intention to meditate is to feel better, I tell you to you might want to look at it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that we don't feel better. In fact, when we're reading the Buddha's instructions on noticing the jhanas, there's an aspect of noticing how you're feeling better, but it's only because your mind is becoming more concentrated. You go from that first initial stage where I'm directed myself, directed thought. My mind is now in its body. That's the first jhana. The second one, the directed thought falls away. And as directed thought feels away, there's naturally, your brain has stopped churning material all the time, information. It's naturally calming. Calming feels good, doesn't it? So the natural result of a concentration practice is feeling good. But if I go to my meditation practice with determination that I'm feeling lousy and I want to feel good in 5 minutes, I've missed a point. And I might feel good in 5 minutes. I mean, for some people, not everyone, sitting quietly makes them feel better, especially if they don't do it too long without any structure. And so then that feels like, okay, meditation's really working for me.
This was the first time she asked the question about meditation. You would say there's something better than just meditation.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've had that all. I've had people call me. In fact, even within the center, you hear me ask everybody, do you have a meditation practice? And sometimes they might say, yeah, I've been doing this. And for the last 3 months, I've been doing this particular practice and I feel great. And I have to burst their bubble because that's why they're in front of me. I mean, I don't say, boy, what a fool you are. But I say, like, this is a technique that the Buddha taught. Why don't you try this? And have your focus be using meditation to deepen concentration. And every one of you has felt good after meditation, haven't you?
Yes. Yes. Once I got out of the frustrating part.
Well, that's right. But if I told you that meditation is for you to feel good right away, mm-hmm. and you felt frustrated, you would say either the old guy don't know what he's talking about or I can't do it. But everyone can deepen their concentration, can't you? Again, the Buddha taught a meditation technique that anybody could do as long as they had that second factor of right intention, because it carries it through. And then right effort supports our meditation practice too, doesn't it? And then when we start looking at it and understanding the Eightfold Path, we realize that the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path support a concentration practice, and at the same time, our concentration practice is supporting the other seven factors of the Eightfold Path. In the future, I may have such a feeling. In the future, I might have such a perception. In the future, I might have such a fabrication. In the future, I might have such a consciousness. This is called projecting thoughts onto the future. Don't do it. And how does one become entangled with the world? How do we become entangled with the world? Anybody wondering? An uninstructed, ordinary person, lacking understanding of the Dhamma, sees form as self. Or the self as form. That's how we become entangled with the world. And why is that? Why is seeing this form as self entangle me in the world? Because I'm doing that because of my fabricated view of who I am in the world. And as long as I continue those views, I am entangled in the world. Whatever occurs outside of me now is going to affect my view. And if it's not what I like, it's going to cause me stress and disappointment. And as the Buddha taught earlier, I have no control over any of that, do I? The only thing I can control is my thoughts and the way I think in relation to the world. I'm not going to see form itself. Or the self as form. Confused. They see feeling as self or the self-possessing feeling. How many times have we said, I feel this way, or I feel that way? I had an awful day. It's just a day. Confused, they see their perceptions as self or the self as possessing perceptions. Just as an example, without getting into it, look at the political climate in our country and other places today in the world. Those are all coming out of fabricated perceptions because we see the perceptions as self and the self as those perceptions. Confused, they see their fabrications as self or their self as their fabrications. Confused, they see their consciousness as self or their self as their self as their consciousness. This is what is meant by becoming entangled with the world. So it's clear about what that means. And how is one not entangled with the world? A follower of the Dhamma who is well-versed and well-trained in the Dhamma does not see form as self or the self as possessing form. With right view established, they do not see feeling as the self or the self as possessing feelings. So if you want to develop this dispassionate way, develop right view. With right view established, they do not see perceptions as self or the self as possessing perceptions. With right view established, they do not see fabrications as self or the self possessing fabrications. With right view established, they do not see consciousness as the self or the self possessing consciousness. What if these five clinging aggregates, if let's say form was gold, feeling was diamonds, perceptions was, what's another?
Rubies.
What is it?
Rubies.
Where am I in this analogy? I lost it my own. They own an analogy.
Fabrication.
Fabrications are platinum, and what consciousness has got to be a good one.
Sapphires.
Consciousness is sapphires. So this is how I'm viewing what I am, what I'm made up of. I'm made up of all these valuable things that I'm completely enamored with, and I don't want to let go of one of them. That'd be an awful way to live our lives, wouldn't it? Hanging on to these shekels that are truly shackles. Yet that's what we do. We treat form, feeling, perceptions, fabrications, and our consciousness as the most precious jewels in the world, when in fact they're impermanent fabrications. They're not even a little bit of a problem. They are the problem. And so when we understand it as it really is, as the Buddha's teaching, we simply let them go because you realize there's nothing valuable. I'm not letting go of platinum and diamond and jewels. I'm letting go of something that is injurious to me, that is taking my life away. Why not let it go? This is called not being entangled with the world. To develop an auspicious day, remain present with your life as your life occurs. Everybody feel they can do that? Be present with your life as your life occurs.
Yes.
With concentration.
Yeah, but with the right development of the proper skills, you all know you can do it. It's not something that is impossible, is it? And so why wouldn't we do it? In fact, it's not something that's really all that hard, although there's challenges along the way, because we want everything right now. But as soon as we start integrating the Dhamma wholeheartedly and faithfully, no faith involved, it begins to change us. For the better. It makes us what we're hoping to be. To be present with our life as our life occurs. And that's its own reward. It's the biggest reward. It's the biggest lottery. What more could we want out of life? Knowing that everything else that we could add to these six properties is just an embellishment and a fabrication. And it does not mean that we don't enjoy the things of the world. We simply don't define ourselves by the things of the world. You could have the biggest pile of rubies. And as long as you're not attached to them, if you're not losing sleep over them, enjoy your rubies or anything else. But if you're finding that you can't sleep and you're worried about all the robbers that are going to come and take your rubies, what's the best thing to do? Find somebody that can use them, because I don't need them. Years and years ago, one of the first jobs I ever did, I was lucky to get it. I got the roofing job for, I got to be careful, right? For a gentleman who owned a huge pharmaceutical company. He was an older man who met this future bride, who was 40 years his younger, in Poland. Well, you know what I'm talking about. And so he married this young, she was a caretaker for his children. And he bought a castle in Poland, dismantled it, flew it all back or shipped it all back over to here to Princeton and built this $21 million Polish mansion for her. She was Polish. Jasna Polana. And to make the point, and actually, and now that I said it, Seward Johnson was a remarkably generous and compassionate man. So I'm not saying anything. Seward Johnson?
Yeah.
Is he really?
Yeah.
No, not the old man died a long time ago. Okay. Yeah, maybe. There's the Johnson family is huge. It's a,
I think that's Seward Johnson. It's like a nephew of that. Grounds for Sculpture is still.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a nephew
Jimmy
of
Johnson.
This guy.
Yes, yes, that's right. Yeah. Seward Johnson would be about 130 right now.
Yeah.
So anyway, so he built her this beautiful castle. And I was lucky enough to get the roofing job. We got these, and that really has nothing to do with the story, but I want to tell it. I had to buy these 1-inch slates from England and have them shipped over. It was just beautiful stuff. It was remarkable. And the cost of that was, you know, I was young and I didn't price it out properly and it almost killed me, but it was just an incredible place. And I noticed that every time Mr. Johnson and his new bride left the place. There was an armed guard, an armed fence all the way around his property with armed guards everywhere. Every time we showed up for work at 7 o'clock in the morning, we all had to get out of the trucks and they tore through all of our equipment to make sure we didn't have anything. And I can understand that part of it. Every time Mr. Johnson and Mrs. Johnson left, they left in separate Mercedes. And I finally got the guts to ask one of the other caretakers, I said, why do they do that? Why don't they travel together? It seems strange. And he said the reason why they do that, is if one of them is kidnapped, the other one's left to spend the money.
Yeah.
And can you? And again, I can understand why someone would think that way. But why would anybody want to live their life in their own prison like that?
Right. But there was a time, like in the 70s or 80s, where a lot of CEOs in New Jersey were being kidnapped or...
Yes, that was just, that was at that time.
Like several.
And that's why I said.
New Jersey has a lot of,
It was stopped in like,
somewhere
in the Middle East or something.
No, that's the point I was making. It's understandable why they would do it. Oh, sure. It's understandable, but it's I would give it, if I had to live that way in order to keep my millions, I'd give it away. Why would anybody want to live that way? Mr. Johnson did. But that's the point. Anyway, let me finish this.
I'm afraid by the scenery. It's beautiful, John. Thank you for the sunset.
You're
are
welcome.
Making it far more beautiful.
To develop an auspicious day, remain present with your life as your life occurs. Do not chase the past or project your thoughts to the future. Remain free of entanglements with the world, and mindful of what is occurring. Be mindful of impermanence and uncertainty. Those that do so will have an auspicious day. So says this peaceful sage. Thank you.
John, what sutta was that?
The Bhadakarata Sutta.
Is that in your book?
Yes.
Bhadakarata. That was
a good one. Well, you've heard it before, haven't you?
I know.
Yeah. It is a good one.
I
not the way you read it.
You know? Yeah, and it's just one of those ones I want to put in my back pocket for.
I would
really
strongly
suggest.
Yeah, hang it on your refrigerator. It's just such so inspiring, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
and it gives us such clear direction.
Well, it's just relief and release. I hear the words.
Yeah, if I want to have an auspicious day, I know what I need to do. I need to be mindful of my life as my life occurs. And by the way, you can all start practicing that right now. I hope you are.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.